The purpose of this talk today is, it was advertised with a little bit of a catchy title, a new twist on the old art of love, or the old idea of love. What I'd like to do is to make it clear that this is not about romance. I'm not going to talk about romance today. That is some people's idea of love. But I would like to take it to a much, much more profound level that really applies to all relationships. That not just someone's significant other in your family or someone you're interested in, but every working relationship you have in your job, in your business, in your social life. That's what we're going to come out of here today. And I'd like you to come out with two things. One is a deeper understanding of what we mean by a healthy relationship, a Jewish idea from ancient Jewish wisdom of what that really should all be about. And second of all, I'd like you to walk out of here as advertised with two practical tools that you should be able to then either enhance any relationship you already have or turn around a relationship that maybe needs turning around. How does that sound? I want you to hold me to that. And in the limited time we have, I'm going to try to accomplish those two goals. You know, I do a lot of teaching. If people see my book, you know that I do a lot of teaching on a more basic level of life, even more basic than relationships, is simply how to become a connoisseur of things. And many of us are very good at becoming connoisseurs. Many of us enjoy good music, a nice bottle of wine, going to an art gallery. We've become very, very good at this, and yet when it comes to relationships, we tend to fall down. Why is that? Why is it that we do really well when it comes to enjoying life's finer pleasures, the aesthetics of life? Last time I was here, I gave you, those of you who are here, a chart that looks something like this. And this chart was a series of concentric circles, almost circles. And I put right here an A for aesthetics. That aesthetic pleasure, such as I mentioned, enjoying a glass of wine or a work of art, or anything that is to do with the senses, that's a type of pleasure we have in life that we can cultivate. And we spoke about that at length. A higher level than that, though, is what I call love. Now, love really is a code word for relationships. And I think everybody would agree that a loving relationship is at a higher level than simply aesthetics. Most people agree. Not quite everybody. But I'm reminded of the analogy taught by Rabbi Noach Weinberg about the guy who, someone comes into his office one day, a stranger comes in and says, you know, I'd like to offer you $50 million for your daughter. Now, nothing's going to happen to her. We're going to take care of her. We're going to give. She'll be healthy. She'll be raised in a very healthy home. You'll just never see her again. $50 million. That can buy a lot of aesthetic pleasure. Most people would I hope everybody, but not everybody, most people would not take the offer, right? Why not? Because we know that there's absolutely no exchange rate here. No amount of physical pleasure can be exchanged for a true loving relationship. You know what that guy's going to do, though, that night when he gets home? What's he going to do when he sees his daughter? He's going to rush up to her, and he's going to think about her and think about his relationship with her, and he's thinking, man, you know, maybe I don't spend enough time with my daughter. Maybe I should take 2 weeks off. So talks to his wife, says, you know, maybe we should take some time off and get to know each other better as a family. I've been working too hard. They take a couple weeks off. They go on a vacation. By the second day, it's a disaster. The kids are crazy. The parents are fighting with each other. They're not having a good time. You know, honey, maybe we jumped too fast in this vacation thing. Maybe we should cut it short. What are they lacking? Why can't they enjoy their vacation if they're a typical family? Because they spend a lot of time, like most of us, becoming real connoisseurs of aesthetics. But they never learn how to become a connoisseur of relationships. And if you're not a connoisseur of something, you know how you enjoy it? Think about it. Anyone here drink wine? Almost everybody. Now, I'm glad you're sitting down. This is something I like to tell people when they're sitting down because it's kind of shocking. There's actually people out there who can't tell the difference between a $5 bottle of wine and a $50 bottle of wine. Can you imagine? Now, what does it take to tell the difference? Don't say $45. That's an old one. What does it take? How do you, those of you who drink wine, how does someone learn, is able, how do they become able to enjoy a $50 bottle of wine and appreciate the difference?
By having $50 to spend.
But then, what more do you have to have? You have to practice, learn to distinguish. That's one step. The other step is you have to learn to savor, right? Because even a wine connoisseur could theoretically do what? Guzzle the wine any given time. So it requires learning about it and also learning how to slow down and savor it. That's what it's going to take for relationships. To cultivate loving relationships and enjoy that pleasure so that your family vacations don't turn into a disaster, let alone, you know, just every night at home or every morning rushing off to this or that. In order to learn how to become a connoisseur of relationships, we have to first learn about them, and then we have to learn how specifically how and put in a practice of cultivating them every day. And so it's not just theoretical, it's actually practical. As you, those of you who were with me before might remember, along the journey we're going to learn about this real problem. That it's a problem and it's also the solution to all these levels. And by the way, some people may notice there's a higher level than this as well. This kind of scares people because they say, wait a second, I thought love was the ultimate. It's actually not. There's actually higher levels in love. That's what I'm talking about in Deerfield tonight, is the third level, because they've already been through the first two. But we will learn about and talk about a little bit this issue of the body versus soul issue. And what this has to do with becoming a connoisseur. Because if you think about it, in terms of when you drink a glass of wine, what happens when a person drinks a glass of wine and they're not enjoying it? Their body's enjoying it, but they're not savoring it as a soul. That's what I mean by those terms. Without going into detail, the same thing's going to happen with love. The body has a role. It can trick you. It can cause you to consume something without savoring it. But it also, without those taste buds, I really wouldn't enjoy that glass of wine. The body has a very important role in this spiritual pleasure that we're talking about, and we have to learn how that works in terms of relationships. So let's get into it. What is therefore love? What does this word mean? What I'd like everybody to do as I put some words on the board is, if you have paper and pencil, it's best to do it on paper. But if you don't, do this in your mind. I'd like you to answer the following questions as an exercise to really get yourself into this. First of all, think of two or three people that you love without any effort. It's so easy to love them. They're just so lovable. And second, think about two or three people that you love, but it takes some effort. It doesn't come so readily. Third, think of two or three people you simply can't love. They're just unlovable. Even one person would be sufficient. If you can think of one person that they're just an unlovable person in your life. It could be someone at work or someone else. Two other things I want you to think about. One is, I'd like you to think of a moment, any moment in your whole life, when you felt this strongest, when you really felt love. And then think of the contrary, a moment in your life when you really felt a lack of love. And with all those thoughts in your mind, can someone give me a definition of love? Since you're able to answer the question and think about someone you love and experience of love, tell me, what is love? What is love?
Trust.
By the way, you can't get it if you don't know what it is. Maybe you can get it, but you can't cultivate it. Yeah. Someone said trust.
Connection.
Mutual what?
Generosity.
Mutual generosity. Yeah?
Sacrifice.
Oh, it sounds so heavy. We've sacrificed so much for you. You're so ungrateful. Anyone else? Want to add to this list?
Commitment.
Judaism would take this list that you are making up here and say some or all of those have something to do with love, but none of those is love. Because I could trust somebody, I think, and not necessarily love them. I could feel connected to somebody,
perhaps, and not necessarily love them? That's how you test your definition. Could I be mutually generous with somebody without loving them? Could I sacrifice for somebody without loving them? Could I be committed without loving them? I think they all have something to do with love. And I'm going to give you a... Yeah, Alan?
Well, love is when I really feel good when I'm with that person.
Alan, thank you for the nice segue for me. I think love, we all would agree, is some kind of feeling. Right? Love is a feeling. It's a good feeling, by definition. And what I'm going to give you here is actually two definitions. One, which I would call your basic definition, or your immature definition. And second, your mature definition. And each one, you can't get to the mature one without the simple one. The simple one is the path. The simple one is the one we all experience on occasion. The mature one is the one that you need to cultivate to become a real connoisseur. So we're going to start with the simple one, which is what Alan's talking about. Basic love is a feeling. It's a feeling of pleasure. What kind of feeling is it? Well, I enjoy the goodness in this person, right? It's a feeling of appreciation of another person's goodness. Okay? That's your basic Jewish definition. By the way, that's the key. That teaches you how you can love somebody. This teaches you how you actually can do it. Do you see the secret there? If love is the appreciation of someone's goodness, then in order to love somebody, what do I have to do? If you want to love somebody, you're having difficulty loving. How do you do it according to this definition? Appreciate them. Well, how do you appreciate them? Appreciate what about them?
Acknowledge what they do.
Appreciate what about them? Find something good about them. This, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is why the Torah in the book of Leviticus is able to command that you should love your neighbor. I mean, think about it. This is a very strange commandment. Love your neighbor? What if I don't like my neighbor? What if my neighbor's a disgusting person, an unpleasant person? How can you command me to love somebody? Well, you can, according to this definition. Because every human being has something good about them. Or almost every human being. Almost everybody. Probably every human being we know today. Got to find that thing that's good about them and focus on that. And according to this definition, if you can focus, the degree to which you can focus on their goodness is the degree to which you'll love them. So think about that person. I asked you to think about someone you had real trouble loving. Right now, pause and think about that person. Think of something good about that person. There's got to be something. It could be simply the way they tie their tie, you know? It could be something very, very simple, but at least find one little thing about them. Maybe they always show up to work on time. Maybe in spite of all their unpleasantness, at least they're punctual. So focus on that, and you'll get a little bit of a feeling of goodness about them. Doesn't mean it's a lot of love, but it's a start to something. Okay? By the way, interrupt me if you have a question. The whole idea here is that just like learning how to savor wine, savoring that relationship requires cultivation. It doesn't come automatically for all relationships. It comes in order that after you cultivate it. And by the way, from a kind of a rabbi's perspective, if you came to me one-on-one and said to me, what am I supposed to do with this terrible person in my life? What I would tell you is, you were given that person as a gift to teach you how to become a better connoisseur of love. Because without that challenge, you wouldn't ever have to exercise that muscle to that degree. So rather than feel unhappy about that person being your life, on the contrary, you should look at this as an opportunity for me to develop and deepen that relationship muscle that I'm trying to build. Without effort, there's no reward. Without pain, without struggle, you can't build that muscle. So look at that as an opportunity to develop yourself in that area. I'm not suggesting you go for that workout every minute of the day. But once a day, once a week, whenever you have to encounter that person, what a great opportunity to develop your ability to focus on somebody's goodness. And you become a connoisseur of love. That actually, unpleasant people is not the big tripping factor here. The thing that trips people up most is a total misunderstanding of what this means. The biggest misunderstanding we have is from Greek culture. You know Greek culture? It's permeated our culture, so I refer to it a lot.
but it's really into Hollywood, Hallmark cards, Valentine's Day. According to this non-Jewish view, what's love? It's getting shot by an arrow from this little guy named Cupid, right? Now think about the problem with that definition. If you believe that love is something that just happens to you, like it got shot by an arrow, here's the problem. A guy's married, happily married for 20 years, right? Then guess what happens? One day, he doesn't come home from work. Honey, I'm not coming home. Why not? What's the matter? I fell in love with my secretary. I couldn't help it. I got shot by that jerk, that Cupid guy. I couldn't help it. It's not my fault, right? You can't stay married with that kind of view of love, right? What's going to happen? So he'll marry the secretary, and then 10 years later, he gets shot again. A successful marriage, according to that model, is just avoiding getting shot by this arrow. It doesn't work. That's not the Jewish view. In fact, that's not love at all. You know what that is? That's infatuation. That is, instead of the confusion there by that person is, love is what we call a soul experience. And the equivalent of that is with a body, is what we call infatuation. Infatuation is the bodily experience of a relationship as opposed to the soul's experience of the relationship. We want to use the body to serve the soul and not let the body serve itself. This goes to all types of areas of life, including drinking wine. A connoisseur of wine means I'm sublimating my senses to my mind and my soul, and I'm not letting the taste buds just go out of control. A person who does that becomes an alcoholic. The way that I avoid becoming alcoholic and I learn how to cultivate is by understanding the body is subordinate to the soul. The body serves the soul. And that's, you can only do that if you understand that when you feel that arrow hitting you from Cupid, don't think of that as external. Oh, I couldn't help. Oh, beautiful woman, beautiful man walks by. Oh, I'm in love. No, you're not in love. That's infatuation. That's my body. It's like when you walk through the kitchen and you tell yourself, well, I really shouldn't have any cookies. But maybe just one. One's not going to mess up my diet, right? One cookie, I mean, that's not going to be a big deal, right? One cookie? So you have one cookie, then what happens? I mean, if I could have one, I could have two, right? And pretty soon you've had 10. And then your significant other says to you, what happened to your diet? I couldn't help it. The cookies were calling to me. They're shouting out my name, right? That wasn't the cookies calling you. That was your body calling you. And if you recognize that arrow of Cupid is not external, it's internal. That's me calling me. But I don't want that me to call me. I know that that's danger. That's a trap. That's going to get my body to have a good time and my soul is going to be utterly devastated. If I want to have a true experience of real love, of real relationships, I can't listen to those signals. I've got to do what it takes to cultivate real love. And the only way that I can do that is through effort. This is effortless. Just go have a good time. This is hard work. Which do you want to do? Hard work or easy time? Easy time, right? If you want to grow to greatness spiritually, you got to be ready for effort. You got to be inspired every day. In fact, this is so fundamental that everything I've seen in Judaism, all the different books about Judaism, they all say you have to start every morning waking up ready to have this effort. Like in having this consciousness, today's going to be a struggle. If you don't have that consciousness, if you just want to have an easy time, you can do that once in a while when you go to the beach, right, on vacation, but that's not a way to grow throughout the year. Otherwise, your whole life just becomes one long vacation. So how do we actually do this then? I told you a trick. You know, the trick is to understand the definition, but how do you actually on a daily basis practice this? Well, when you talk about your children, if you have children, or someone who you're related to and you really care for, it's easy. Well, not so easy, but it's not so hard either. It comes more naturally. We naturally love our children or people who are our family members, but we don't naturally love the guy or woman we work with in the office. We don't naturally love the person at the grocery store or the guy, the attendant at the gas station. In fact, we often feel a glass wall between us, literally and metaphorically as well. We feel this distance. They're behind this glass wall, and all we're doing is transacting money here. How do we develop this idea of I want to be a genius at relationships with everybody? This is your key, ladies and gentlemen, to becoming great at your real meaningful relationships, is realize that it's not just about you and your significant other. not just about you and your parents, your children, or you and your neighbors. It's about you and everybody. If you're going to become a true connoisseur of relationships, it's going to permeate every relationship. This idea of cultivating goodness, therefore, has to be something that you build into your psyche. How am I going to do that? I'm going to take you to what I told you is the mature definition of love. This is the first level, but the mature definition of love, you understand that... I want to leave... Who said connection? That was... Okay, I'm going to leave that up there because it's related to that word. That was a nice word, connection. In Hebrew, the word for love is... Anyone know it? A lot of people know it. Ahava, which is spelled in Hebrew letters, ahava. Okay? Now, ahava has, like all Hebrew letters, you can come up with a numerical value for it. You know, the gematria system, every letter has a value. So aleph is 1, bet is 2, gimel is 3, and so on. So aleph is 1, hey is, alphabet. Hey, 5. Bet is 2, and hey is. Okay, put that in your calculator. Oh, you're very fast. Okay. So that equals 13. The numerical value, the rule in gematria is if you have two words with the same numerical value, there's some interconnection between them. That's the whole thing of gematria. The only interesting thing with gematria is that it shows you relationship between words in the spiritual language. Another word that has the numerical value of 13 is echad. 4 plus 8 plus 1. What does echad mean? 1. It means 1. So, this mature definition of love is a feeling of oneness with another person. A feeling of connection with another. That's what mature love is. Mature love means I see there's something connecting me and you. And that tells you, by the way, sometimes I teach this topic and I have a woman in the room who is visibly pregnant and I'll ask her, are you going to love your child? She says, of course. I said, well, how do you know? Maybe he's going to turn out to be a brat. How does an expectant mother know, absolutely sure, that she's going to love her child? Based on this definition, she already does. She's literally one with the child. And this is natural for a mother, and this is why, by the way, a child growing up is harder typically for mothers and fathers. And this is why a mother's love for a child never ends, no matter what. Although a child can feel very distant from their mother, and you know, unfortunately even forget about their mother sometimes. Mother never forgets about her child. Fathers usually don't either. Because of this feeling of, this child was a part of me. This child is I'm connected to. There's a real sense of that. That's where that comes from. So mature relationships, and this doesn't have to, I'm using parent-child obviously as an example, this applies to any relationship, is cultivating a sense of oneness with another person. I would like to go back to that person that you have a hard time feeling any love for. How do you do that? Based on this definition. How do you cultivate a sense of not just, okay, I'm going to look at how he ties his tie and therefore he's punctual and therefore I'll focus on that part of him. How do you develop a sense of love, just a basic connection of that with that person, with that relationship, based on this definition? How can you feel oneness with somebody who has all these bad qualities that you don't like?
Separate the
what? I'm trying to help you cultivate the feelings. You have
but
to separate.
But it starts from understanding.
What I'm suggesting you do is actually focus on what. On this concept of oneness, focus on what you have in common. Anyone here ever traveled to a foreign country? When you were traveling, did you run into any Americans? You know how it feels when you travel and you run into Americans? Hey, some Americans. There's something about that. I mean, maybe some people don't like to run into Americans, but I used to do this experiment. I used to live in Israel. You've probably heard about, in Israel, there's a lot of bad feelings between the religious Israelis and the secular Israeli Jews. And I used to do this experiment. If I was with a religious Israeli, like a cab driver, I would do this. I was practicing my Hebrew, so I do this in the cab. I would say, what if you were walking down an alley, midnight, and you run into a group of secular Israeli teenagers with earrings and tattoos, teenage boys, how would you feel? Pretty scared. Okay, take the same situation, but now you're in downtown Ramallah. Pretty happy. You get it? I say the same question to the secular guy. You're walking down at midnight, and you run down this alley, and you're trapped, and there's a bunch of Hasidic teenagers. How do you feel? Pretty scared. Okay, same situation, but you're downtown Ramallah. Pretty happy. Why? What makes them happy if it's downtown Ramallah?
Because now you have something in common with them. They're not
these are fellow Jews. Regardless of anything else, these are fellow Jews. And I feel a connection. Even though you put me in downtown Tel Aviv and we hate each other, downtown Ramallah, we're best friends. You can find that connection, that commonality, I hope, with any American. You share American culture. With anyone in Chicago, you're from Chicago. You ever travel, and if you're traveling and you meet an American, and it turns out not only they're American, but they're from Chicago. And not only they're from Chicago, but they grew up a block away from you, and they went to the same high school. Wow, that's an amazing coincidence. You're all happy. Most people react with some pleasure to meet somebody with such commonality. Well, find the commonality. Focus on the commonality. We're working in the same office. We're both Americans. We're both... We grew up in the same culture. What's the ultimate commonality that we can share with somebody? Fellow human beings. We're fellow human beings. You know, there's a famous line. I didn't make it up. I wish I did. People are always, you know, trying to have a spiritual experience in life. And I tell them, you're not a human being having a spiritual experience. You're a spiritual being having a human experience. That's what you're doing. We're fellow human beings. We're fellow spiritual beings having this common experience of being human. And if you think about that, it's true. If you think about that, you probably agree with it. And that's the fundamental lesson of the Torah. When the Torah introduces the topic of humanity, what does it say? How does it introduce humanity into the Torah? You've all heard this. God created Adam in the image of God. Every human being is created in this, whatever this means, divine image. But the lesson there is saying it's not about Jews, it's about humanity. The way we can recognize our commonality is to see that we all have this holiness to our who we are. We all have this divine image, however you want to define that. You want to take that as a metaphor, fine. But understand that that's the lesson that we need to apply if we want to really feel that oneness, which is going to give us love. By the way, this also tells you both these levels of love, both the feeling of appreciation for goodness and filial oneness, tells you why people can love their cars. You know anybody who really loves their car? Because they spend a lot of time with the car, and they appreciate all the fine qualities of the car, and they start to do what? Identify with the car. The car becomes an extension of themselves. It sounds funny, but it's true. That is why someone can really love their cars. We can do the same thing with other human beings.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Doesn't it have any influence what the other one feels towards you?
Not necessarily. The question was, does it matter, does my loving or having a warm relationship or feelings towards the person, does it depend on how they treat me? Well, shouldn't. A mother's love for a child is independent of how the child behaves.
That's a different relationship. I'm talking about you gave an example for
Alfred. Yeah, well, that's a different relationship, but it's an ideal. In other words, we're human too, right? But are you going to approach that person as egocentric, you know, I'm only in it for what they can do for me? Or am I approaching that relationship as, this is another human being. If they have flaws and make mistakes, that's not going to change my basic attitude towards them. This is another human being who deserves my respect and deserves to be treated with dignity, even if they have flaws. It's a high level, isn't it? It's a very high level. But it requires, and that's why it requires cultivation. It doesn't come automatically. Because we are bundles of ego and selfishness, all of us are. And that's why Judaism would say, you were given, as I said before, you were given that person in your life to help you get out of your ego, to help you become more selfless and more other-focused. Yeah, not that you should let them walk all over you. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm not suggesting you should take abuse in any way. But that you should, your attitude towards them, if they are not kind in the relationship, is your attitude should be almost like a loving parent towards a wayward child. You still love them in spite of their flaws. It doesn't mean you have to spend a lot of time with them. Do your best. Let's take that question and apply it now to reality. Now, how are you going to actually do this? How are you going to actually apply this wisdom to your relationships? Not only your most difficult ones. I don't want you to just focus only on the difficult ones, but also on the ones that are medium difficulty.
Two steps. I promised you two practical tools to get you there.
One is, well, one we already talked about, focusing on the positive. But for mature love, you have to, first of all, be willing to take the time. You have to be willing to take the time to cultivate.
Are you willing to take a wine tasting course? Are you willing to take an art appreciation course? You're willing to take the time for those. Are you willing to take a human being tasting course? That's what you're doing right now.
But it's not just a one-hour course. It has to be a few hours. It has to be a discipline. It has to be something you think about on a regular basis. It has to be something that you develop as you develop any other discipline. Think about an artist. Okay, an artist, how long should it take a great artist to paint a great painting? What do you think? How long should it take a great artist to paint a great painting? In your opinion?
One month.
Do I hear anything else?
It could be an hour if you have that inspiration that comes from
there. Okay, 1 month, 1 hour, any other opinions?
Years.
I think no time range.
2.5 weeks? One of my favorite lines in all of films that I've ever seen was Amadeus, when the king, I think it was Leopold, says to him, "It was a beautiful piece of music, just there's something wrong with it, something I didn't quite get like," and some whispers into his ear, "Too many notes, sire?" "Yes, that's exactly it. Just a few too many notes." And Mozart was a little stunned by that. "Which notes would you like me to take out, your highness?" A great painter, do you know how long he has to take to paint a great painting? As long as it takes. It could be 1 hour, it could be 1 month, it could be a year, it could be 10 years. A great painter will take however much time it takes to paint the painting, right? A great relationship artist, as you all are going to become in a few minutes as we finish up this discussion, will take how long to develop a great relationship, to make a great artwork out of a relationship? As long as it takes. Your commitment to that relationship needs to be, I'm going to put whatever it takes into this relationship to make it work. It might take a month to me to settle this and get it on a good footing with this person. It might take a year. It might take 10 years. It might take a lifetime. We don't typically have a lifetime with all people we relate to. Typically, we only have that with one or two people. What should happen, though, if I did have a lifetime with people, with somebody? What should happen? According to all that we've had on the board before, all that we've been talking about, what should happen between, let's say, a typical marriage between a man and a woman, they are married for a long time. By the way, today is my grandfather's yard site. He passed away on this day, and my grandmother passed away 2 days ago. It was 2 days ago, but she died actually a year after him. So she was buried on his first yard site because the funeral was 2 days after she passed away. This is just a couple of years ago on the West Coast. And when at her funeral, I had done this calculation. We put her in the ground next to him on his first yard site. It occurred to me, and I did this calculation, because I knew when they met, I knew the exact date that they had met, that they were together. They knew each other, that is, actually from the day they met to the day that he passed away, for 70 years and 70 days. That's how long my grandparents knew each other. They both lived in a very old age, thank God. You ever seen a couple who have been married a really, really long time? I have a picture here. I should get this blown up, but I want to show you this picture. This is a couple I met in a couple weeks ago in Miami. And I looked at this couple. And before they said anything, I said, "Don't tell me. Let me guess how long you've been married." I wish the picture were larger, but if you can see it from here, from where you're sitting.
You gotta pass it around.
Okay. Can you guess how long this couple has been married?
They look like
Don't they look like brother and sister?
They look like brother and sister. They're, whenever you see a couple that looks like that, probably they've been married for 50 or 60 years. This couple's been married 60 years. And not only do they start looking like each other, they're able to complete each other's sentences, right? Without any animosity, they're just completely what?
One.
They're completely one. That is only happens rarely, that we get to such unity with another human being. Okay, that's okay. That doesn't mean we can't strive towards more unity with everybody. The key is to be committed like an artist to how long?
As long as it takes.
And that means the person in your office or the person, your next door neighbor or your spouse or your child or your parent, whoever it is that you want to develop your relationship with, it is to have the attitude, I'm in this as an artist. I'm not going to walk away from this. I'm going to try to make this happen, and I'm going to give it as long as it takes. That's the key. A second step, or a part of this, is, I'm going to put this in blue, is to internalize. Because, let's face it, we're all human. And this guy rubs me the wrong way every time I see him. And I trip up over it every time. I lose my temper. I'm impatient. I'm turned off. I run the other way. I avoid the conversation that I know I should be having. I need to internalize my desire and my sense of unity with that person. And the great trick we have for this in Judaism is actually a meditation. It's the oldest meditation I'm aware of. Someone was noticing that I have a CD over here about Judaism and Hinduism. And I don't have one on Buddhism, but the Buddhism one that I'm teaching this next month in Baltimore, I'll probably record that. The reason I chose Hinduism for the first one, because Hinduism and Judaism are approximately the same age. They date back both, you know, a long, long way. And Buddhism is much more recent. But we don't have any, as far as I know, any Hindu meditation even. No religion we have a meditation as old as the great meditation in Judaism known as the Shema Yisrael. You know the Shema Yisrael? Shema Yisrael, most of us learn as kids, maybe think about, and most of us learn it and know it as adults with a five-year-old understanding what it's all about. What is the Shema Yisrael in a nutshell? Let's put the words up here. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu. I think if I just without any commentary, you can look at that and already your brain's thinking about the connection between this and this whole discussion about relationships. What's the first thing you notice connecting to this discussion?
One.
The word echad, right? Oneness. There's something very, very important here. If you understand, what's the word shema mean? Hear meaning what?
Listen.
Listen. What else can hear mean besides listen? What?
Ability to hear?
Internalize.
You hear what he said? Yeah, but did you hear him? You know, hear can mean really internalize, to really deepen my understanding of something. So this is a declarative. This is actually an imperative statement. Who is Yisrael?
Us.
Jewish people, right? So if someone says the Shema, they should shout it out, right, so they can all hear me. There's actually a synagogue in Jerusalem where they literally, two blocks away, you can hear them. There's like 1,000 people, and they're shouting out the Shema. But if I'm all alone, Yisrael also means me, just me. I am a Yisrael, because I am one who struggles with grappling with divine wisdom. That's what it really means. And so this is really a meditation to myself. Listen, internalize you. Alexander Seinfeld internalized the following 2 points. That this creator of the universe is running everything, and that this creator of the universe, and here's the key point right here, is, what does echad mean?
One.
One what? What does it mean to say God is one? What does that mean? He's one of many different gods? He is oneness. All there is. Doesn't really make sense. I mean, it kind of makes sense. It doesn't really make sense, because I see lots of stuff around me. I see jet envelopes, and I see books, and I see cards, and people, and lights. I don't perceive oneness. I perceive multiplicity. In order to understand oneness, I need a meditation. I need to close my eyes, literally. This is how the Torah says you should do this. And Jewish tradition says you should actually cover, try this. If you close your eyes and then cover them, look how much darker it gets. You can try it right now. And when you make the room really dark, then you're emphasizing your hearing instead. And it makes this into a meditation about internalizing this wisdom. The only way to internalize this idea of oneness is to meditate on it. It's the only way, because otherwise I don't relate. I don't live life that way. I live life as multiplicity. If this is said, if I do say this properly, what do I end up with? What's the end result? How does it change me?
You connect I one with everything.
For one moment, and it usually only lasts for a fraction of a second, I feel one with everything. I feel totally connected to everything and everybody. And that's the key. That's your second practical tool. The Shema is a powerful, powerful way of, and the Torah says you should say it once in the morning and once in the evening. Frame your day with this extremely challenging, it only takes about 10 seconds to say it, but it's really hard to say with focus as a meditation. It's easy to blur out the words. It's not easy to use it as a meditation, to pause and actually do it. And in fact, in order to do it properly, to use it so you can really internalize this idea of Echad, the tradition has it like this. You should make sure that your phone's turned off for those 30 seconds, and make sure that you're just sitting down in a meditative posture, which means upright breathing easily, and then have two warm-up ideas. Before you say it, first, warm up with the idea of it's morning. Hey, it's a morning, new day. And if you're saying it before you go to bed, look out the window and say, oh, it's nighttime. So the first warm-up is the time of day. And the second warm-up is, think about this. If this is true, and you don't have to be a religious person to think about the possibility that this sentence is true. If this is true, then by definition, if I'm connected to this thing we call God, then by definition, this thing called God is what?
Part of me.
Connected to me. And by definition, that means God, as we're defining it, loves me. So this B is to think about the metaphorical downward flow of this love. The downward flow. That if God created all this, God must feel connected to us as well. To feel that I was created for a purpose. My life has meaning. I'm not just a jumbled bundle of genes and monkeys bumping together that produced humanity, that there's a purpose to life. We're here for a reason. We have a spiritual mission. And that purpose has something transcendent about it. That's that downward flow of love. Then I say the Shema with those two feelings. Anyone know what the next word is said in the Torah after the word Echad? After the word Echad. The next word is V'yahavta. And you will love, you'll send the love back upwards. So what the Shema really is, see, the Shema goes here.
Doesn't it go up at night and down?
Nope. It always comes down, and then this is C, and D is we send upward, we send our love back upward, so to speak. That's how the Shema is typically said. This is not a whole, I'm not giving a lesson on the Shema or the prayer book or anything. I'm just showing you how this meditation can be used to cultivate love, to cultivate oneness. And by doing so, hopefully it'll seep into my consciousness so that when I see a person that rubs me the wrong way, or even someone that I just have an average relationship with, I should start to see that person's transcendent nature, that we're connected in a, not just that we're both Americans, or we're both from Chicago, or we're both in the same office, or we live on the same street, but we're both wavelengths, if you will, of this divine creation called this universe. That's beautiful. That should help me cultivate love with anybody.
I have a silly question to ask you about this. To me, the Shema was always meaningful as a sung verse as opposed to a meditation. And I'm curious to know what you...
As a sung?
Sung. As a song. You know, as a sung chanted. I'm curious to know what your sense is as a meditation that's a spoken as opposed to a sung meditation.
I don't care how you vocalize it, but it's to say, be said properly according to everything I've learned and studied in all the Jewish books. Properly means focusing on the meaning of each word. If you can do that, singing it, beautiful. I personally prefer to state it, to say it, but some people sing it. I don't have any preference.
I would think that singing it, especially in a congregation, creates a connectivity between other people. So it's like some places sing it and then they chant it. So by singing it, you're getting outside of yourself and you're sort of sharing it. By saying it, then you're going down.
You know, I know some people who love to go to musical concerts, and I know some people who hate it, prefer to listen to CDs. There's different strokes for different folks. I don't advocate going to do that in a congregation if it doesn't work for you. But if it works for you, beautiful.
Right.
That's wonderful. I want to recap now because we're running out of time. I want to recap and just mention one thing. What's the ultimate unity in a relationship? What's the ultimate expression of unity in a relationship? I think we would agree, is intimacy. I just read an article about how diamonds 50 years ago, no one thought of them as romantic, but it was all and there's so many diamonds in the world that they should be very, very cheap, but the price is artificially kept high in order that there should be profits for the De Beers company. That's an interesting idea. We create these constructs about, but what is it? How is it that a diamond could convey love? And because does a diamond convey love if they cost 50 cents each? No. It only conveys love because it's appreciated. And know what even conveys love even as much as a diamond? Fresh flowers. Because what they says by a diamond or fresh flowers or a handwritten note as opposed to an email is, you matter. You matter so much, I want to create a special bond with us. Between us. And the most special bond created between two people that's literally possible is physical intimacy. Now, that's not a topic for now. That would be an advanced topic we could do another time. And usually when I teach about physical intimacy and how to use physical intimacy to create real love as opposed to infatuation, I usually do it men and women separate or just for people who are maybe for married couples. But that's a little foreshadowing what could happen in the future. But to recap today, we covered two points. Two points. Simple love. Basic love, which is defined as how?
Make a connection.
How do you cultivate love on the most basic level?
You find the goodness in someone.
Look at the goodness in them and focus on that goodness, right? Mature love is what?
Oneness.
Focus on the connection, on the oneness, what we have in common. Now, you can go do that without the Shema. You don't need the Shema necessarily. The Shema is just a very useful Jewish tool that I know you already know the word, so I thought I'd give you something you're familiar with that can help you cultivate that and deepen it. Because ultimately, and I put this as our summary today, the ultimate connection, the ultimate transcendent, is the transcendent connection, which is illustrated by my chart. I had A and I had L here. You notice this is pointing somewhere? Anyone remember from reading the book or previous times what's up here? But up here I put a T. A T stands for the transcendent. That stands for what we just spoke about. The idea that the creator of the universe is created all this for a purpose. That we'd ultimately have what Judaism calls Dveikut or Dveikus, depending on which side of the tracks you're from, which is a sense of, I'm not just one with you. But you and I are one with the creator of the universe as well. We're one with the transcendent, infinite God. That's what we're ultimately one with. And when I recognize that you are created for me, you are. Did you know that you were created for me? At this moment, my attitude towards you should be, you were created, you were given to me as a gift that I could have whatever our relationship gives me. And that may be, it gives me the opportunity to give to you. That may be what it gives to me. It's not necessarily selfish in terms of the direction. It could be that I get from the relationship the ability to give, but that I should recognize that you're a gift to me. And if you can look at anybody in your life and say, that person's a gift to me in his or her own way, you're guaranteed to love them. I hope this was useful. I want to thank again Alan and Rabbi Kahn and Pamela for bringing me back, and I hope that we'll continue our relationship and cultivate our love a future time.